What I'm going to talk about is gravity as a double copy of gauge theory. And this is work that I've done with John Joseph Carrasco, who's over there, Lance Dixon, Henrik Johansson, and Radu Roybaan. And then there was the three of us. And then I'll spend some time talking about some work with my student, Tristan Denon, and then Yutin Wang, and then Michael Kiermaier. And this will be about the Lagrangian, what Lagrangian has this property. But before I talk about any of the details, what I want to do is give you the basic vision of what we're after here. You know, why are we doing this? And I think the vision is pretty clear, right? Okay, so let's start with planar n equals 4. And of course, what do we want to do? We're going to solve it, right? And I think every single person in this room believes that we're going to solve it within our lifetime, that we're going to see the solution. Now, what exactly solve means, I leave that to you. And it also depends on how young you are and how long you live. But but anyway, by any reasonable definition, it's pretty clear we're going to be making a lot of progress in the planar case in the coming years. And there'll be a lot of progress discussed in this workshop. So the idea is, if you've solved this, can you go on and solve the non-planar case? So non-planar n equals 4. So in this case, everybody says, oh, of course we can solve it, because it's an integrable system. Right? At least that's what people say. So this is integrable and solvable. Now, the non-planar case, nobody thinks that's integrable. But is that really important? I don't think so. What's really important is, can we solve it? Right? Now, in Marcus's talk, he made a very important point. He was talking about hope. So if you think this step is hopeless, then I guarantee you're not going to do it. But one of the main purposes of my talk is to try to give you some hope and explain that, in fact, there is a very strong link between the non-planar case and the planar case. And if we solve this, we're going to, you know, I think we're going to solve this as well. Okay, and the reason is because there's a very rigid structure. That's really what my talk is about, a very rigid structure between the planar sector of n equals 4 super Yang Mills and the non-planar sector. So there's this duality that I'll be talking about. And that'll be a duality between color and kinematics. Now, the story gets even more interesting. It's actually in the title. If we've got this fellow under control, the non-planar case, and we understand how to go from here to here, then I think for sure we're going to go very far in n equals 8 supergravity. Now, if we're talking about the integrands, so we're going to talk about amplitudes. Let's say we're talking about amplitudes and the integrands of amplitudes. Okay, we know a lot about this, and we're going to, like, tomorrow we're going to have a talk from Nima, who's going to discuss this. Then the idea is that we use this duality to go from the planar case to the non-planar case, and then this step here to go to n equals 8 supergravity is completely trivialized. It takes 5 seconds to take this step. There's nothing to it. And that I'll explain. So for the integrands of amplitudes, this problem has been trivialized. Now, the problem...
I see a slight contradiction between your notion of solvability and talking about integrands.
Oh, of course. We'll get to that in a second. Basically, what I'm going to tell you is, you're not solving a damn thing until you know how to do the integrals, right? But the problem over here of solving, let's say you're going to say solving this, I'm trying to talk about at the integral level, well, I think we better make a lot more progress on this problem just in the planar case. And in fact, that'll be something that is going to, I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion.
When you talk about integrants, you're feeling in
particular. Yes, I'm talking, that's right. What I'm going to tell you is absolutely everything that you're saying is very important. But, okay, but what I'm going to explain in this talk is what we know and then where we want to go. So this thing right here, I should have made this a little clearer. This is the vision. This is not what you know, we can do today or tomorrow, but this is where we want to go. Okay? And of course, I'll explain where we are, which is really going to be at the level of the integrand. Okay. But the key thing, the key message that that I want you to get from what I'm saying here is, I call it the hope that if we get this guy under control, we will be moving along here. And that's really going to be one of the important points of my talk. Okay? Okay, so there's some issues, and we already heard from the audience about issues. So the first problem is right here. So we can make this step trivial, but we have to improve the representations of the amplitudes, and I'm using the word representation the same way that Marcus was using. We have to reorganize this amplitude in the proper way to make this step easy. So we need one of the issues. So let's list now issues. So it's now like a reality check. So before a minute ago I was dreaming, now back to reality. So what we need is better representations of planar amplitudes, or more control, I should say. More control. Okay, the next thing is, you know, I can use the word solve all I want, but if we cannot integrate, then we have not solved. So like we're actually doing the quantum theory. Now, another obvious thing is everything I'm going to talk about in any kind of detail is going to be about S matrix elements, the on-shell S matrix elements. So what we want to go, obviously, we want to go on-shell to off-shell. And this I will have something to say about. And more importantly, we want it to be very general, not just S matrix elements. We want to talk about, for example, general classical solutions. We want relations between gravity, general classical solutions, say a black hole, for example. We want to understand it in terms of two copies of Yang-Mills solutions. So we want also to go to talk about let's see, general classical solutions.
Yeah, there's an intermediate step, which is the high energy scattering, which should be making black holes, right?
Right. Right. That's right. So, in fact, the path, I mean, to get here, you have to, the proper way to do it is think about situations which are as close as you can get to scattering amplitudes, but connect to general classical solutions. Now, I know I'm not allowed to use this word in this workshop, but I'll use it anyway, and that's Lagrangian. We want a Lagrangian. That was a joke. Come on, guys. Okay. That was better. Okay. And then I'll be talking a lot about supersymmetry, but of course, the world is not entirely supersymmetric. So we want to, of course, think about Susie to non-Susie. Okay. Okay, so that's the introduction. Now let's get down to business. And now to show you what we know. And then near the end, I'll talk about a little more about where we'd like to go.
If you have a field theory and you know all the planar amplitudes, do the experts think that you can produce black holes?
From the planar? I don't think so. No, no.
You need the full.
No. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. Gravity planar is not. Mm-hmm. Not sure what to make of that.
No, but maybe you meant like that it is CFT, but gravity is the one around it. So
yeah, you do need gravity.
Ah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, so first let's talk about tree level.
Hockey radiation is one of them.
Oh, hockey, yeah.
That's
what
we care about.
Yes. So, okay, I've got these grandiose statements. We're going to solve the theory, but let's just talk about tree level first. That's a place to start. So, so how does it work? So first, let's consider some scattering amplitude. Okay, so this would be. Let's call this AM, and they could be labels 1, 2, all the way to M. Okay, et cetera, all the way to M. Okay, and the way we're going to describe this is in terms of diagrams. Things that look a lot like Feynman diagrams, but they're not Feynman diagrams. It's just a way of describing the amplitude. We're going to describe it in terms of diagrams with cubic vertices. Cubic vertices. So I don't have to keep on saying diagrams with cubic vertices. I'll just call them cubic diagrams. Okay. Now, suppose I had a contact term. Let's say you're doing Feynman diagrams, right? Then you pick up a contact term. Now you say, okay, that contact term is not doesn't belong with a cubic diagram, but I'm going to use an identity. Which is almost as good as the one that Andrew Hodges mentioned, 4 equals 2 times 2. My identity is in the same league. P square over P square is equal to 1. So you notice there's a missing propagator here. So I'll just stick in the propagator and then cancel it out in the numerator. Okay, and that way I can make any diagram, any Feynman diagram, I can make it cubic. Just by that trivial kind of rearrangement. So the idea of cubic diagrams is kind of trivial. You can always do this just by multiplying and dividing. Excuse me? Yeah, that's right. There's an ambiguity. In fact, there's an ambiguity of exactly how to do that. But whatever you do, as I'll explain in just a minute, the way that you make the assignment of where it belongs is according to the color factor. And that'll uniquely pick where this term belongs.
Sweet.
And then you stick in the right propagators, yeah?
Given that you're allowing yourself to use this identity, do you have an updated version of one particle irreducible that takes into account that, I mean, you're going to, as we were discussing the other day, you're going to write non-one particle irreducible.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's right. I guess I don't understand the question.
You're allowing yourself to do this.
Yeah.
Is there a restricted notion of when you get to higher loop diagrams, you would normally have one particle irreducible parts?
Well, if you're, yes, that's right. Now, if you're talking about n equals 8 supergravity, which I'm sure is in the back of your mind, in that case, those propagators are all fake anyway, because what happens at least the contributions, and I'll tell you, here would be an example, something that you have in mind. So we're going to be drawing some diagrams like this. Mm-hmm. So you say, okay, that's not one particle irreducible, but that pole is actually not there because of this identity. Let's say this propagator was 1 over S. It just happens to be that the diagram has an S, so actually there is no pole there. So it doesn't affect what you're worried about, at least for n equals 8 supergravity.
So can you formalize this and give yourself a free pass on certain types of reducibility? I mean, you showed us right there how you can, that one you know.
Yeah. In general, how about this? If we're talking about a general field theory, For example, we could be talking about pure Yang Mills, or we could be talking about pure gravity. Then, in fact, you know, this is one particle reducible. So in general, we have to worry about what you're saying. So it's not a free pass in that sense. It's only a free pass in n equals 8 supergravity and n equals 4 super Yang Mills.
But the point is that the actual scattering amplitude is not associated with the one particle reducible diagram. So it has a potential.
Well, he's interested in
calculation.
In his mind, I was just translating.
I'm interested in counter terms, right?
Yes, exactly.
Focus on the right. Particle reducible.
Right. That's why he was asking. Absolutely. That's why he was asking the question. Even though no one else understood my answer, I think I was answering your question correctly. I mean, no one understood why you were asking it. Okay. Sorry about the little detour, but anyway, let's get back on track. So we can take any tree amplitude, and let's make it m point, and we can write this as a sum over these cubic diagrams, and then we have a label I, and I just enumerates the diagram that I'm talking about. And then di, so these are the Feynman propagators. This guy here is the color factor. So it's just our FABCs. And this guy here is everything else. So this is the kinematic numerator. Okay, and these are cubic diagrams. And as I explained, it's trivial to put even, I'll say, Feynman diagrams into this form. So that's not very profound. Well, let's look a little bit closer. So let's look at 4 points. So at 4 points, let's pick one diagram like this. And the color factor, maybe I'll give it label CS for S channel. So that's the Mandelstam channel that I'm labeling there. So that guy, we know what he is. It's a little technical thing, but to prevent the proliferation of bad factors, I'm going to redefine my FABC, I over root 2, and then the ordinary FABC. People should rewrite their textbooks, by the way, to use this. But anyway, never mind. So the color factor, and this is elementary. I'm saying something elementary just from the textbooks, is I'm just going to address it FABC, FABC, and that'll be my color factor, A1, A2, B, F twiddle, B, A3, A4. That's the color factor. Then there's a numerator. That numerator, I'm not going to write it out, but it's easy enough to calculate however you like. It looks something like this, epsilon1 dot epsilon2. And yes, I know it's forbidden to use polarization vectors in this workshop, but I'm still going to do it. epsilon 4 dot k3 plus many more terms. So it's some, collection of dot products of polarization vectors and momenta. Okay, and these numerators, I'm not putting any special restriction on them. They could be local, they could be non-local. Now, if I make it non-local, you might ask, what do you mean by a numerator? Because, you know, it's got a denominator. Well, what I mean by a numerator is anything that's not one of these Feynman propagators. And the Feynman propagator is specified by these cubic diagrams. So if there's anything else, let it be another factor of 1 over S or another factor of 1 over T, I don't care. We'll stick it in the numerator. Okay, in fact, also some of these things might be zero. That's also allowed. The only constraint on what I'm picking here, at least at the moment, is that I get the correct amplitude. Okay, so what do color factors do for a living? And the answer is that they satisfy the Jacobi identity. So what's the Jacobi identity? Well, we take this 1, 2, 3, 4, then okay, let me leave that leg one there, and then a third one. Okay, and then we'll make this one 3, 4, 2, and then 4, 1, sorry, 4, 2, 3, and that's equal to 0. So that's the Jacobi identity. So that's pretty trivial. And anyway, so that, not very profound. And another thing that color factor. So this is now. So these are now. This is now. Let's write this as CS. This is the color factor CU, and this one we'll call CT. And those three color factors add up to zero. So this is now a picture. This identity here. This is for color factors. So the color factor, it does something else for a living. It's anti-symmetric. So if I have 1, 2, 3, 4, then we know that's equal to minus. So again, this is the color factor I'm talking about. Minus 2, 1, 3, 4. So again, that's a triviality. Now, what we're going to claim, the key claim, so this is the key claim, is find yourself all these Jacobi identities. Then for every Jacobi identity, so let's write down a Jacobi identity. C alpha plus C beta plus C gamma is equal to zero. And the signs are kind of arbitrary because it depends on how you define what these color factors are. You know, there's an arbitrariness. There's some signs you have to be careful of. But let's just assume with some set of signs, it comes out with plus signs like that. And the key claim is that for every such identity, these numerators here can be put in a form such that they satisfy exactly the same identity. So for this for a one-to-one correspondence to this identity, we have another identity, n alpha plus n beta plus n gamma is equal to zero. Now, you have to watch my words very carefully because I didn't say it's always going to work. I said there exists a representation where this is true. There is a way of putting it, putting this amplitude here into a form such that the same identities are satisfied. And also the same thing, if we have that, let's say C alpha goes to minus C alpha under some permutation of legs, like right here, I flip the legs, I get a minus sign. Then corresponding to it, the numerators have to undergo exactly the same transformation, the same sign. And the importance of this is that now the same algebra that color satisfies, namely Jacobi and various anti-symmetry properties, is now satisfied by numerators. Okay, so the N alpha and C alpha share the same algebra. Same algebraic structure.
Sweet.
Yes?
Do you need supersymmetry for this?
No, absolutely not.
Just generally for gauge theory.
Yep.
Any gauge theory.
But notice I'm talking about, first I'm talking about adjoint representation. That's the first thing. And second thing is I didn't tell you about what happens when you have a lot of fermions around, a lot of fermion species, and I won't. Okay, but it's very generic. Okay, so for example, it's going to work in n equals 4 super Yang mills, in n equals 2, and of course pure Yang mills.
So how much of this comes in a simple way from sort of trivial symmetries? For example, in a simpler context, if I multiply an anti-symmetric matrix times an arbitrary matrix, and I just pick out the anti-symmetric part.
Basically none of this. Okay. So what happens? Yeah. So what happens? If you go look at 4 points, in fact, this example here, you're pretty much right. In fact, no matter how you do it, you'll find it all works exactly the way I said. So you'd conclude essentially that it's kind of trivial. But when you go to 5 points, then it's completely non-trivial. So suppose that you were to pick Feynman diagrams and you use, I don't know if I should call this Hodges identity, but anyway, he multiplied, I'm dividing. If you go ahead and use that identity and you turn Feynman diagrams into this form, Feynman diagrams into this form, then you'll find it doesn't work beyond 4 points. Okay? And what you have to do to make it work is move terms around. You have to take contact terms and move them between the diagrams in a fairly non-trivial way. So it definitely does not follow from any simple property, which is pretty easy to check by just giving it a try, and then you'll see it won't work for Feynman for some rewrite of Feynman diagrams. In fact, I'll show you how to make it work from a Lagrangian point of view, which might answer that question a lot better. Okay, so first thing is, we state that there is such a representation. Okay, and the next thing is we claim that it should work to all loop orders. See, you can make claims when you can actually do some calculations to back it up. So we don't have a proof, but at least I can hold off the tomatoes for a while by having calculations to show you, or at least assert that we did them and how it works. So let's look at one loop. L loops. Let's look at L loops. There's the endpoint function. So what we're going to do is put this this amplitude into the same type of representation of only cubic diagrams. So we have the product from j equals 1 to L. So that's the integral. We call it L, 2 pi to the d. Notice I put in d, I mean it's d dimensions. So there's no restriction on the dimension. And then we have to sum over the diagrams. There are numerators, there are color factors. Okay, we're at loop level, so there's going to be those symmetry factors. So this guy will be a symmetry factor. So remember that there's a 1/2 associated with this diagram. So the symmetry factor of this diagram is 2. So that's what I'm talking about. And then we have a bunch of Feynman propagators, which I'll just call DI. So first claim, right here, that there is a representation such that whatever Jacobi identity you have at loop level, you're going to be able to find a representation such that the numerator satisfies that same identity. And to be more specific, suppose we happen to be at 3 loops, then the identity I'm talking about, so this would be now Jacobi identity. In fact, let's give it a different color. The Jacobi identity I'm talking about is that this is equal to this, and then plus backwards by color. Okay, so there's the Jacobi identity. So notice that it's just the ordinary Jacobi identity. If you just isolate right around here, that's just the Jacobi identity. It's this one. There's some relative signs because it depends on exactly how you draw it. So you pick up relative signs. But okay, this way of drawing it, this is the identity. And the claim is that the numerators are related to each other through this identity. And the significance of this, which I'll talk a little bit more about later, is that, for example, if I happen to know these two, I don't need to know that one because this equation gives it to me. I don't have to calculate it. Okay. Now, this is the first part. The second part of the assertion or the conjecture, you call it conjecture, since it's, well, this part here, this is the part that's really unproven. Okay, the existence of such a representation that satisfies this. That's the really unproven part.
So here C is a product of a bunch of Fs, right?
Yes.
And sums of products.
Right.
And the Ns are similarly sums and products of epsilons and momentum.
Yeah, exactly.
And the assertion is that by getting rid of the quartic matrices, you can always
find, right, but to find such a representation can be non-trivial. And it can be, if you're starting, you know, pick a Feynman diagram representation. Uh-huh. To be able to move from a Feynman diagram representation to a representation that satisfies this can be very non-trivial.
Is there a definite algorithm or you just guess?
No, there's a definite algorithm. The algorithm is easy. You make it happen. The constraint is this has to be the correct amplitude. it's easy. We got computers for this. But of course we want to do better, and that'll in fact be one of the points that I'll want to emphasize in this workshop. We got to do better. You know, we want to just be able to write these fellows down. We don't have to say, oh, you impose the constraints and make it happen. We just want it to happen. Just write it down. That's what we're after. Okay, so that's the first part.
First of all, it's almost time for our break.
Oh.
But could I ask a question?
Yes.
Such a representation is not unique, or is it?
No, it is not unique.
Are you going to comment on the degree of non-uniqueness?
I could just quote some things, but the amount of non-uniqueness, yeah. Actually, yeah, let's hold off that question because the non-uniqueness is actually quite huge.
Oh, yeah.
There's really a lot of stuff you can do. I'll have to talk about a concept called generalized gauge invariance before it trying to answer your question.
Can I ask you a related question,
yeah,
perhaps? I mean, so nothing is planar here, and yet you're talking about the integrand.
So you see this equation? There is, as far as these three contributions are concerned, there is an integrand in the sense that I got my labels.
There's no ambiguity in the momentum routing.
There's no, yeah, because it's the same diagram everywhere except circled. Right. So there is an integrand as long as you focus on three at a time. Right, globally, there's no integrand.
Does that mean that the trivial shift of what you would mean call the loop momenta from diagram to diagram is one of the legal moves that you can make on the ends keeping in this form? I guess you're saying it is.
There's
no integrands. I just take the Feynman diagram,
right,
and just randomly shift.
Well, this is a
the loop momenta.
Yeah, and there's still ambiguities of what you can do.
But I think you're saying because of this fact that we can zoom in on.
Yes, you're zooming in at three at a time, and when you do that, all the question of what is the integrand is not a problem in the sense this is now a well-defined function of. The labels are all the same everywhere. You know, especially these guys, which is the part that's changing between the diagrams. So here it's a well-defined function. And in a sense, your concern, so Nima is pointing out is if you take, you know, one integral here and you take another integral there, things can move between them simply by shifting this one compared to that one. And then it's ambiguous. But here, these numerators at the level of the integrand are being locked to each other. So once, for example, if I know these two, this guy is unique. Once these two are specified, I'm done. It's unique answer.
So then the act of putting it to the appropriate form fixes. So
yes.
Okay. So, yes. So it's the opposite of what I said. So if you put it in that form, and then you do this random change of the you just shift the momentum between different diagrams, you'll take it out of the.
If you start moving them independently, you've got a problem. Mm-hmm.
So your identity always involves three C's, right? But
yes.
There are many more CIs.
Right.
So you pick any set
yes.
of three, any
This
three.
Is for all.
All sets
yeah,
of three.
Yeah, it's for all. It better be for all.
Uh-huh.
Right. Now, the reason why we need for all is the next step, or the next step, the next part. Which,
sorry, it's me.
Oh.
I wanted me to remind you.
Right. Okay, so I got 5 minutes. I'm just going to write down one equation. And this is Yang-Mills, and now we're going to talk about gravity. And in a minute, I'll say a little bit more about which gravity theories, but let's look at L-loops. And the claim is, if you have imposed all of this, all of them, it has to be all of them, then gravity is just that double copy that's in the title of my talk. Where's the? Okay, so it's the same numerators. Now I'm going to put a twiddle on the second copy. This twiddle means, this twiddle here is so I have control over which theory I'm talking about. If I'm talking about, for example, n equals 8 supergravity, then this is the n of n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, and that's the same guy. Okay, so it's a square in that case. But for other types of theories, depending on what spectrum I have on this side, I might want it to be asymmetric. You could think of something like a heterotic string type intuition. Okay? Okay, and then it's the same and the same. So the key thing is this n, these fellows here, they don't belong to gravity, or actually I guess they do since it's in the equation for gravity, but they are really the ends of Yang-Mills. That's the key point. These are the ni of Yang-Mills. And this will only work if you've got this set up. If you don't have it set up, you could forget it. It's not going to work. Okay? Now.
So you're saying for regular Einstein gravity?
Gravity, it doesn't quite work in this form, and that's because, now I've got Andrew's equation. It's because 2 times 2 is 4, right? So 2 is the states of the gluon. There's 2 states of the gluon times 2, mm-hmm. right? Will give me 4 states, mm-hmm. but as we know, pure gravity should have 2 states. So in fact, the theory you get has more states in it. It's graviton plus anti-symmetric tensor plus dilaton is what you get in 4 dimensions. Okay. But it doesn't mean you can't do it for pure gravity. You got to project out the states you don't like. Then you should do it. No one has done that explicitly, but I'm sure it can be done.
Okay. Mark and Stas in France, where they solved this first relation in n equal 8 supergravity, and the structure was very similar to this, except there was some dressing function.
Right.
Does it fall into
No. The problem is that, you see, this is exactly n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, and no extra factors, mm-hmm. right? So there's nothing else to calculate. Right. If I have this, I am instantly done here. Right? There's just nothing else to calculate. So this is
something else.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say I want n equals a supergravity. Then the way I would do it is I would take ni twiddle of I would take n equals 4 super Yang nils, and then times the second copy would be again n equals 4. So it's really a square. Now, if I want, let's say, argument sake, you know, n equals 6, I'm going to pick some other supergravity, then I would, the way I would do it would be n equals 2 times n equals 4. And if I want, we can call it n equals 0, which would be that theory of the anti-symmetric tensor, the dilaton and graviton, then I would take, on this side, n equals 0, meaning pure Yang nils, times n equals 0. So you can kind of design, if you're interested in some particular theory, on this side, you can design it by picking the appropriate super Yang nils or the appropriate Yang nils theory to put on that side. And now that sounds like a coffee break time, or tea break. Is it tea or coffee? Oh, but anyway.
How long?
Okay, cookies. That's it.
How long before we start?
15 minutes. Okay, so there's an important concept that I have to explain, which is generalized gauge invariance. So suppose I make a shift of this n here, and I just consider ni goes to ni plus delta I. So this is some general shift. This thing here can be any function of any variables you like, except maybe the color. Stuck in the color, you get a little confused. But this is a function of anything that you want, any arbitrary function. And the constraint that we're imposing is that this amplitude here be invariant. So right now I'm saying something trivial. Generalized gauge invariance is the set of all possible transformations of these numerators that leaves the amplitude invariant. Okay, so that part's trivial, but here's the non-trivial part. Let's make exactly this same transformation on gravity. So I'm going to take this fellow, and I'm going to replace him with ni plus delta I, like so. Now, the delta I dropped out of this amplitude if I made that shift. In fact, let's just do it here. Ni plus delta I, it drops out. Well, that's what the delta I do. And the reason why it drops out is there's a certain algebra of these C's. What's that algebra? Oh, there it is. Right? Satisfied Jacobi, has certain anti-symmetry properties. And by using those identities, we can eliminate this. Well, lo and behold, this fellow here would satisfy exactly the same algebra. So therefore, that drops out as well. And it's as trivial as that. So gravity amplitudes have a generalized gauge invariance induced by the set of possible transformations that you can do in the Yang-Mills case.
Now, this is keeping n-twiddle fixed.
Yeah, so I'm keeping n-twiddle fixed.
So you might also shift n-twiddle?
Right, you might. But then you have to worry about the cross terms. Mm-hmm. So then you're allowed to do transformations where the cross terms vanish. Right? And there's a freedom of doing that. These n's are most definitely not unique objects. They're not unique whether, like, let's say you make it not satisfy the duality. So right here, let's say I mess up the duality. Right? So this ni plus delta I does not have to satisfy the duality. So that's one possible transformation. Another possible another possible transformation is that these delta i's don't ruin the duality. Right? Now, the first thing you learn from here is that you can immediately find representations of gravity where only one copy satisfies that duality. You don't need the second copy. This second copy can be any representation whatsoever. Very cool. Right? So one copy has to satisfy that, The other copy can be any representation, even, heaven forbid, Feynman diagrams. You can use that just as well. Okay. Now, the amount of freedom you have, let's say that you want to keep the duality, the amount of freedom you have, it depends on the details of what you're imposing. For example, let's say 4-point tree level, in that case, anything you do, as long as you define numerators and denominators the way I said, you'll find it works. At 5 points, let's suppose that you impose that the numerator be local, that it be a local expression, then there's in fact one parameter freedom. Okay. And then if you make things non-local, there might be, you know, a greater freedom. Maybe one amusing thing, this three-loop case of n equals 4 super Yang Mills or n equals 8 super gravity, if you impose the locality, that these numerators have a local structure, then the answer is there is no freedom. There's a unique expression that satisfies the duality. Now, there's a few more comments that I need to make. So the first thing is we're going to hear a lot about dual conformal symmetry. And dual conformal symmetry is the basic trick of how you do planar n equals 4 super Yang Mills. You use that symmetry, and it greatly constrains the numerators. But the problem is that representation that has dual conformal symmetry, it does not have, it does not satisfy the duality. The representation that does satisfy the duality, let me just pick one diagram, that numerator, in case you care, it's s squared t over 3, and then t minus s, and then a tree. This thing, for those of you who are really quick on dual conformal symmetry, we will immediately see that this does not satisfy dual conformal symmetry. And that's related to the problem that I said, that we need to have much better control over the planar amplitudes. We need to be able to push it into forms easily that we like. Like this one is a good form from the point of view of this duality. It's a bad form from the point of view of dual conformal symmetry. The planar amplitudes either way are identically equal to each other. If they weren't, then one of them would be wrong. So, okay. So, anyway, dual conformal symmetry, I should say manifest, dual conformal symmetry is lost. And what we would certainly like is a way of going from the expression that's dual conformal invariant to the expression which satisfies this duality in a slick way. If we could do that, we would be very far along to having a solution of the non-planar expressions for, well, wherever you have a solution in the planar, you then have a solution in the non-planar case. Okay. Now,
can I ask a
yeah, sure.
So, let's say we take, I don't know, 6-point, 6-point NMHB at tree level.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say we put it, it is presented in some BCJ form, which is local.
Mm-hmm.
Do any of the forms look familiar? I mean, are any of them like, do any of them look like Baron's schema? Do any of them look
no,
like,
no, we.
Given that. We're doing this retro thing.
Yeah. the answer is no, but the answer is no. They don't.
Maybe more specifically, is the Baron's Hilbert form? I'll say it the other way. It's not in the BCJ form. First.
No, I haven't checked, but you know, it's not going to work. You got to push the thing in the right. You know, it takes some effort to get it into the right form. It's a rare day when you go to the literature, you pick up a form, and it's the right one that you need. That doesn't happen very often. So what's the significance? Why are we excited about it? So we work, what we like doing for a living is loop calculations. So anything that helps us do loop calculations gets us excited. Right? So let's look at one loop. So one loop Well, there's only one diagram, and this is, we're talking about n equals 4. Okay, so the one loop is only one diagram. And okay, maybe that's not such a big deal, but let's look at two loops. At two loops, we know that there's two diagrams. There's a planar and there's a non-planar. So let me maybe draw it like this. There's a planar and a non-planar. But what this duality does for us is we don't need to worry about that guy, because once we have this guy, this one's automatic. We just know him because the equation tells it to us. This equation tells us what the numerator is. Now let's go to three loops. Well, at three loops, it turns out that in n equals 4 super Yang Mills, well, depending on how you organize it, but let's say there's 12 diagrams. But in fact, we only need to know one of them. If we know this fellow here, we're done. We got all of it. And the duality, like I said, just gives us the rest. At four loops, story is basically the same. Now, we like planar, so we want to express things in terms of planar amplitudes, or sorry, planar integrals or planar diagrams. Let's go to four loops. Ah, it's okay, I can squeeze four loops right in here.
So you could have picked any three loop diagram and gotten
No.
Okay, so
what's
the condition?
That you have to be able to solve these equations. You have to be able to solve these equations. So you solve the equations in terms of, whatever you can solve in terms of. And this is the guy that you can solve it in terms of. I can solve it in terms of other ones as well, but there's a limited set that you can solve it in terms. And we give this guy here a name. We're going to call him the master diagram. Because, you know, once you know this fellow, you've solved the problem.
Which theory are you talking about?
I'm talking about n equals 4 super Yang Mills, but the same basic idea will work in any of the theories I'm talking about. In pure Yang Mills, n equals 0, same story, but the number of masters is going to increase on you.
Yeah. I understand you correctly. If you solve this integral,
I'm talking about the integrand level.
You just know the integrand.
Right. Yes, the unfortunate right. Yes, in fact, that's right. At least not yet, but you know, we would love to be able to carry things from the integrated. So you integrate this, and then use that information to tell you about the non-planar integrated version. For that, we'd have a big party if we could do that. In fact, that'll be on my list of problems that a person like you should work on. Okay. So at four loops, we have two masters. So again, this is n equals 4 super Yang Mills. And once again, you don't have to choose these guys as the masters. It turns out that in this case, you can choose a non-planar guy as a master, and then there's only one of them, which is actually kind of neat. But I guess in this workshop, we don't like non-planar, although we're going to like it a lot more by the time we're finished. Okay, so now an important question that I'm sure many of you have is why the heck should you believe us? I mean, okay, I made all these conjectures and claims, oh, it works like this, this is the answer, but why believe us? Okay. And of course, the reason is because we have examples. It's the data that Marcus was talking about. We have data, and the data, well, it's not quite as good as the data from the LHC, but okay, at least it's data that we have to figure out the structure of the theory. So the first thing is tree level.
It's not affected by energy resolution.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you don't have to worry if that bump is real or not. Okay. So first of all, at tree level, there's really overwhelming evidence that what I was telling you was correct. In fact, there is even an explicit formula, and that explicit formula, so there's an explicit formula that tells you what Ni are. So it's an example, it's a solution of the duality equations. it's known. And it's in turn, so it's Ni, the numerators in terms of amplitudes, and this was worked out, actually more like written down, not worked out, but kind of written down by Kiermaier and then Bjørn Borre and then Paul Damgaard there, Sundergaard, wherever you are, and Pierre Van Hove worked that out. So we have it in our hands, an example that it really works, and we know exactly what the formulas are. Now, this is one representation. This representation is non-local. It has other properties, like crossing symmetry, which are not happy, but at least it's an example. So, and there's also a lot of quite a bit of investigation of the consequences of the duality, and they all check out. It's also in string theory, it's been checked. So let's anyway give this guy a check. So this guy, at tree level, we should believe it.
I mean, is there a kind of a number of particles beyond which it's unclear?
No, the formulas. Sorry, I wasn't clear.
Formula.
Yeah, I wasn't clear about this.
So
this
you
is all
a generating formula that's got all
yeah, or it's not even a generating formula. It's just the answer.
Is it MHB full MHB?
No. Not. It's just the answer, right? Yeah, just the answer. Right.
The answer.
Just the answer for any amplitude. You plug it in their formula, and you get out the set of numerators, and those numerators satisfy the duality relations.
Given the amplitudes.
Given the amplitudes, right. Given the amplitudes. Okay, but all amplitudes are solved, so. Okay, so.
Just a quick comment about that.
Yeah.
Many people have stated the gauge invariant content of the statement as mm-hmm. some relations mm-hmm. between color ordered amplitudes. Mm-hmm. And it's very bizarre that the gauge invariant statements are much less illuminating,
yes.
evocative seeming than your statement.
I think that's correct. Yes.
But still, the last I checked, it wasn't clear. If someone handed you the gauge invariant statement, is there any way you could back a guess this?
You could certainly back a guess by rewriting things in terms of numerators, and what you get is formulas that. I'll just make something up. Something like this.
If someone handed you,
it'd be hard to guess. But there, you would be, with the right insight, you'd be able to guess it because you can rewrite those amplitude relations as some relations between groups. Uh-huh. In these groups divided by kinematic invariance, and if you had your eyes open and you put it in exactly the right form, at that point you might say, gee, you know, this would be a lot easier if these worked individually instead of in these types of groups.
So, and just one comment. So people have, I think, proven these statements as following from the so-called bonus relations, mm-hmm. from the fact that non-adjacent BCFW shifts fall off, mm-hmm. Like one over z squared rather than one over z. Just a comment. I don't know if it's known or from, but Freddie has found a very beautiful proof of these relations directly from the connected prescription.
Oh, sorry, which relations? The bonus relations?
Not the bonus relations. Directly the relations. Directly the simplest way those relations are written. I think there's a paper by Friedman and Franzman. I don't remember.
Sorry, which relations?
I'm talking about the
amplitude or
amplitude relations, which are equivalent to
right,
an ECJ.
Right.
There's a number of ways of writing. There's the simplest possible way of writing them. I forget who did it. Okay. And the proofs that this follows from the bonus relations are pretty long. There's a five-line proof that it follows from the connected prescription.
And who wrote
Freddie,
that?
Freddie Kachok. Well, he hasn't written it.
Oh, he hasn't written it. Okay. Okay.
So there's a very, very.
What are the relations you're talking about?
I'll write down one relation. So I'll write down the very simplest one. The other ones I can't write down because I don't remember them exactly. Okay, so. And you may even remember this guy from your string days. Let's see. Oh, wait, it's still your string days. Sorry about that. Okay, something like this. Let's see. One, two. Yeah. No, I screwed something up. This guy's a U. Maybe a minus sign. So it would be a relationship between amplitudes, and it has kinematic invariance between it. And this generalizes for any number of legs, and we know explicitly what those relationships are. And those are the ones that have been studied in great detail and proven and so on. Proven from string theory, proven from field theory.
Well, I was just going to say, can I just state then that all the obstructions to finding the NRI have been identified and solved to be vanishing?
Sorry, all the...
All the obstructions. I mean, so you've written down a list of conditions at the end.
Right. So at tree level, yes. At tree level...
So there's potential obstructions, but they will vanish for reasons that are not completely transparent.
No, it's probably not completely transparent, but yeah.
I mean, something you said, but these things look extremely similar. They're very close cousins of the U1 decoupling mechanism.
They are cousins.
The same flavor, right?
They have kinematics in between
them,
so they're definitely harder to find.
Of course, but I just want to make just
right. There is a connection that.
So these are Yang Mills.
Yes, these are Yang Mills. QCD.
Even before BCJ, there is an incredible fact about tree amplitudes, which is obvious from the Lagrangian, but it's totally obscure from any on-shell way we know of computing them, which is the fact that if you take particle one and move it through cyclically through everybody and add all those amplitudes up, you get zero. So there is some relation between different orderings, which is obscure. I only mention it because that's one thing that the Clister string theory makes completely obvious. Mm-hmm. I think it's the thing that it does better than anything else. And a small update of that statement, a small update of the twister string proof of the one decoupling identity proves these statements too. That's all.
But the U1 decoupling identity you see very easily from the string or not from the inertia.
Sorry? Of course. No, but that's a lot closer to the end. Yes, of course.
Okay, we're going to have, by popular demand, we're going to have a discussion of this from the string viewpoint. Maybe next week, yeah?
This isn't true for string.
Pretty damn close, yeah. They're slightly different, but they're pretty close.
Yeah,
pretty close. Yeah, all the same relations that you find in field theory, you find in string theory, but a little bit modified. But they definitely look the same.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Okay. The double copy. So this is tree level, and this is the duality. I mean, we'll give this guy a check. Then there's the double copy at tree level, and we'll give this guy a check as well. So we proved, under the assumption that this was true, this is with Tristan Denon, Yutin Wang, and Michael Kiermaier. We proved that if this is true, then the double copy works at tree level. It's through BCFW recursion relations that we proved that. Okay, now...
So this is also compatible with the freedom. So you've got freedom of the choice of the NIs, and any choice will double up.
So the doubling up, this is important. So as soon as the duality is satisfied up here, make the duality work. Anyway, as soon as the duality is satisfied, the doubling up we claim is going to work. Well, that's the conjecture, or that's the assertion. Tree level, it's not an assertion; it's proven. Okay. At loop level, the real problem. It's not the double copy. That I think is. It's pretty clear that's going to work. And you can make various arguments through unitarity cuts that it has to work. The real problem is, can you make the duality work? And that's not an obvious thing, because you have to count the number of constraints and the number and the amount of freedom you have and exactly how it balances, and to find out if you can find the solution. But we have evidence, and this would be n=4. So let's talk about loops. So this would be n=4 super Yang nils. Of course, n=4 super Yang nils is where you want to check it, because you can go as far as it's one way you can go the furthest. So obviously that's the one that you want to look at. For L equals 1, 2, 3, 4, and this is, n=4, so it's 4 points. let's make this 4 points. I'm talking about something like this. Well, I erased it, but one of these guys. So this is published. This was published in where we made the conjecture that it works at loop levels up to 3. 4 is unpublished, but in finite time it'll be published. And then other examples are, if you look at 5 points, this is unpublished, but it'll soon to be published by these gentlemen. It'll be L equals, one is kind of simple, and so L equals 1, 2, 3 is going to work. So it certainly is something that works beyond 4 points. Okay. Now, let me just make a quick comment. I won't spend too much time on this. I want to show you something a little amusing. So you all know the representation of amplitudes, A tree. Let's make it an M point, 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, all the way to M. And we're going to write it in terms of traces of fundamental representation matrices, TA1, TAM, and then times what we call the partial amplitude, AM, 1, 2, all the way up to M. So I'm talking about the duality between color and kinematics. So let's do it. Let's swap. This is full of kinematics. This is full of color. So we're going to swap this over. And you may ask, does it work? And of course, the answer is yes. So you can also write the amplitude in the following form. Oh, I don't have to repeat that. The sum, and this is the non-cyclic permutations, and I'll call it tau. Tau is like a trace, but I'm not going to tell you what it's a trace over because I don't know. In fact, I'm going to ask you what's a trace over. And it's a trace-like object that contains the kinematics. And then for this guy, we're going to write a dual guy. So it's a dual amplitude. By dual, I mean I'm going to take all the kinematics. I'm going to replace it by color. So the vertices in here, there is no kinematics. It's only FABCs. Okay, and that works. And in fact, if you take this dual guy and you replace him with one of these, you get gravity. And we've checked this. This is with Tristan Denon. We checked this through 8 points. What was it, 9? 9, okay. Through 9 points. Okay. It's a kind of cool representation, but the thing that it really brings up, I'm not going to dwell on this, the thing it really brings up is there's some kind of group theoretic structure behind the kinematics here. Okay? And the question is, what is that group theoretic structure? Okay, so next topic, this will be the final topic, is about the Lagrangians. So I keep on hearing these complaints, how come you're not going off shell? How come you're not doing it non-perturbative? Et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, what you want to do is get a handle on the Lagrangian. If there's some way that we could write down a Lagrangian that has all these properties, then you could really start talking about non-perturbative physics. Now, I will not have the solution to that. I'm just going to point out certain features that a Lagrangian needs to have to make this work.
Manifestly.
If it ain't manifest, it ain't going to help us. It's got to be manifest so we can exploit it. Okay, so what we're going to do is Unfortunately, we're working in perturbation theory, so we can't do it somehow all at once. We're just going to try to construct it order by order to see what this thing looks like. So we're going to take the Yang-Mills Lagrangian, and we are going to correct it. So this, we can start with the Feynman gauge Lagrangian. Why Feynman gauge? I guess the answer is why not? Seems like a reasonable gauge to start with. And then what we do is we start adding things to the Lagrangian. Put a little prime there. And then unfortunately we're going to have infinitely many things to add. But the idea is let's go figure out what the structure is to give us an idea of what we need to do. Okay, and I'm talking perturbation theory, but the key idea is once we understand the structure, to somehow get all of this in one go. That's what we're after. So what do we have to add to make this work manifestly? And the answer is kind of curious. The answer is you have to add nothing to it. But the nothing, zero, has to be written in a very special way.
Well, because you have this other requirement that whatever you add can be integrated
right.
out.
Right, but it turns out that requirement doesn't tell you that this stuff is zero, because, for example, you change the gauge, right? Then you change your Lagrangian. What's that?
Or a field redefinition.
Right, or a field redefinition. But the idea is this will be zero without a field redefinition. And needless to say, that was a great surprise to us, because we were expecting, oh, you got to make some very complicated set of field redefinitions in order to see how to make this work at the Lagrangian level. But in fact, there is no field redefinition. You just add zero. What does zero look like? Well, it looks like this. Minus 1/2 g cubed. And then I'm going to write it out just so we can look at it. Okay, that's one factor. Oh, I'm not done. Let's see. It's A2, A3, A1, A3, A1, A2. Okay, then another F, C, A4, A5, and then multiplied by a bunch of fields. Okay, so I have to take an anti-symmetric combination. A1, A row, A2, A3, mu, a one of a box, right? And you're about to complain, wait, you made it non-local, you can't do that. But it's okay, I can do anything I want because I am adding zero. And the reason why it's zero is because that is the Jacobi identity. So this factor here in the Lagrangian, it vanishes by the color Jacobi. So it's nothing fancy. No, I'm not imposing it. I'm just adding zero by the color Jacobi. But it has an effect that what it does is it contributes to different diagrams. So these represent three different contributions to different diagrams. They have different color factors, right? But the sum of the pieces has to add up to zero because I added zero to the Lagrangian. Yeah? But what it does is it rearranges the numerators of the diagrams in exactly the right way so that the duality holds through 5 points. So this makes it work through 5 points. And let me emphasize, this is tree level.
So are you saying if you were to write down sort of more or less standard Feynman diagrams for this Lagrangian, it would have this symmetry, does this manifest duality?
But I have, sorry, Wait, so it has the duality, but it's not manifest.
So when you say it makes it work, the original theory has a symmetry.
Right.
So in some sense, the original Lagrangian,
right.
It worked.
Yes, it worked, but we couldn't see it. Well, we couldn't see it. It worked, but we couldn't see it. The problem is that the numerators of, let's say, Feynman gauge, it doesn't work. It's the wrong numerator. So you got to move, you got to add zero in just the right way so that it starts working. Now, it's always there. It's just that we couldn't see it. And it's definitely always there because I am literally adding zero to the Lagrangian.
So that freedom is not really education variance,
actually,
right? It's not a gauge.
No.
Zero.
Well, yeah, right. This thing, well, yeah, that's right. This is a very gauge invariant quantity. Even though it doesn't look that way. It's non-local.
If you were doing it in a different gauge, you would have a different
form. Right. So, so in fact, don't stare at this too hard. You're only going to hurt your eyes. The problem is, with this term, is it's garbage or anti-garbage. The garbage is already in here. And this is anti-garbage that cancels something bad in here. So its structure, if you say, I want to learn the symmetry of this thing, you're not going to learn what it is because it's only in combination with the original Lagrangian that you can see it. But I've got another contribution. I'm going to just rename him. I'm just going to make some small changes. So we'll add something else. So let's call this thing D5. And I'll put a parameter. There's the parameter that will be completely free. And then I have to change this from square to round brackets. And there it is. So this is another term that I can add. Right? It's a very small change. It's another term that I can add to the Lagrangian. It has an arbitrary parameter. It has no effect whatsoever on the scattering amplitudes because it's zero. On the other hand, it has a property that it by itself does satisfy the duality. So for any beta, it still works. That duality is still going to work. So this is a term you want to stare at and hurt your eyes. Because this one has, you could say, a self-duality property. So there's something you can learn from this term. I'm not going to tell you what you can learn from it, but I'm sure you can learn something from this. This is the guy, right here. You want to think about what is this guy special? I mean, what property is it about this guy which makes it have the duality property?
Yeah. The
one
box is a covariant box?
Yes, ordinary box. It's an ordinary box because we're doing perturbation theory. Okay. And at this order, I'm only making claims that this Lagrangian L5 is needed to make only the 5-point work. Mm-hmm. If I want to make the 6-point work, there's got to be an L6.
Is that also zero?
Yes, right. Okay. That is definitely zero.
Yeah. They're all zero.
Well, we haven't gone on, but yeah, that's the obvious, it's the obvious extrapolation. This one's zero, that one's zero. It's going to be zero.
So this D5 gives you some freedom or arbitrary defining here.
Exactly. This beta here is exactly the freedom that you have in moving around the NIs, and also it keeps them local. The NIs are going to stay local. Lagrangian is non-local, the NIs will be local, yes?
Isn't it obvious it has to be zero? Because if you're not changing the 3-point to the 4-point, which you could also add to, and then you get a different scheme, then you might be able to have field redefinitions and different answers. But otherwise, it can't be a field redefinition.
I don't know why it can't.
The field redefinitions would change the 3 and...
Yeah, but I am changing, we'll see in a minute. I am going to change those guys pretty seriously, as you're going to see in just a few minutes. The 3-point guys are going to change, and they're going to change quite a bit. Okay. But if you just hold on a little bit, I should be able to explain more. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Okay, now we've only done this through 6 points. But the pattern is pretty clear. You keep on adding zero, it's non-local, but who cares since it's zero? But
this is all tree, right?
This is all tree.
All tree.
Right.
What is finite gauge? How do we see that we have to use finite gauge?
No, we don't have to use finite gauge. It's you got to start with something. So we started from finite gauge. I guess other people might have started from other gauges.
We still do an arbitrary gauge.
What's that?
I mean, the self-dual.
Yeah, this.
We self-dual for arbitrary gauge.
Right.
That's really something that's.
Yeah. This thing by itself, it's got an arbitrary parameter, and it maintains for any value of the parameter, it maintains the self-duality or self-dual. It maintains the duality property. Okay.
And see, at this point, it's not surprising. I mean, isn't it? You just write down the. You said before that with a lot of work, the duality relations could be proved with any number of things, right? And therefore, you're just exhibiting.
Right.
In a different
That's
way.
That's right. Right. But I want. Right. But the reason we want the Lagrangian. So if we're only doing perturbation theory, this generally is an extremely bad idea because. There's another duality, which is the duality between amplitudes and Lagrangians. Simple amplitude, messy Lagrangian. Simple Lagrangian, messy amplitude. So if we're just talking about perturbation theory, we do not really want to talk about the Lagrangian. The reason why we're looking at the Lagrangian is because we want to go beyond perturbation theory. Although at the moment we're only stuck in perturbation theory. But okay, maybe one problem at
even
a time.
Everything is multiplied by zero.
Right.
This has no effect on the path integral.
It has no effect on the path integral, but what it does for us is it locks, for example, at high loops, it locks the planar to the non-planar, and more importantly, it gives us gravity for free. So that's the next thing I want to talk about. What are we going to do with this? Right. What we want to do with this is turn this into a Lagrangian for gravity. So this Lagrangian, you cannot turn into a Lagrangian for gravity. This Lagrangian, we can do. Okay?
Can I just add a comment?
Yeah.
Many people have made this
yeah.
It smells just like some fancy version of string theory.
Right.
That if we could find some other way of doing string field theory so that when we take the alpha prime goes to zero and then we can eliminate heavy light mixing, then presumably it would have an infinite number of ghost fields and higher and higher spins, exactly like the sort of thing one is seeing.
Right. I'm very delighted we have experts on string field theory
multiply
here.
By zero.
Well, but I mean, multiply by zero is a little bit in the eye of the beholder. I mean, the Feynman diagram.
Okay, so what are we going to do with this? And what we really want is a Lagrangian for gravity. So how are we going to get this? Well, the first thing is you look here and you say, wait a second, this is the wrong form because all of this duality is in terms of cubic diagrams. That's a five-point guy, right? It's not in the class of cubic diagrams. This guy has a contact term in it, effectively. If you count the number of propagators, it's basically a guy that looks like this. He's got a contact term. So what we have to do is make this Lagrangian be cubic. It can only have cubic interactions. And if we are able to take that Lagrangian and turn it into one that only has cubic interactions, then all we do is, if we want gravity, we take that Lagrangian and basically double it. That's the basic trick. Okay. Now, how do you take a Lagrangian that has quartic and quintic and et cetera interactions and turn it into one with cubic? And the answer is, of course, obvious. Auxiliary fields. And that's, in fact, connected to Nima's comment of string field theory. We're about to drown in auxiliary fields. Okay, so the first thing is we need auxiliary fields. So first thing is we got to get rid of the quartic interaction of Yang-Mills. Right? And also, we have to do it in such a way that the dimensions of the fields don't get messed up. We want everybody to have a one-derivative interaction. So that dictates what you have to write down. So I'm just going to write something down. So this is the Yang-Mills, the ordinary Feynman gauge Lagrangian, but written with an auxiliary field. And that auxiliary field, okay, he's got three indices on him there. I'm going to make him propagate. Now, the fact that he propagates, that's not so important, because remember, this is tree level, you know, no determinants. And the main thing is that I just have something quadratic that I can integrate out to recover the original Yang-Mills Lagrangian. Okay. Okay, so this is the Lagrangian at 4 points. And now this fellow I'm going to write this a little neater. This fellow, okay, there's d rho, mu nu, a, and then a, b mu, and then c nu. Okay, so this, well, it doesn't look like it does much. I just now made everything so that it's has no quartic interaction. Now this guy here does satisfy the duality through 4 points, because I stated this earlier that anything you do is gonna work right. It's only at higher points that the problems develop, but this is enough to get a pretty good idea of how to do it. And the basic idea is we're gonna take two copies of this guy. Two copies, and that'll give us a gravity Lagrangian that'll be valid through 4 points. If we want to go to 5 points, we're going to analyze this guy, again, turn them all into cubic interactions, introducing more auxiliary fields. If we want at 6 points, we'll continue again and introduce more auxiliary fields to turn this again into 3-point interactions. Okay, and then the basic copying process is we're going to have a product of essentially Lagrangians, and we are going to just identify, like so, this product of gauge fields we will identify as the graviton. Okay, so let's just do it. Okay, so the Yang-Mills Lagrangian, let me write him in the following way. So first of all, we want to do this in momentum space, because we're trying to mimic the numerators of the diagram, so we need to express everything in terms of momentum space. DDK1.
When you make that identification, do you have to symmetrize?
You mean because of, well, this is a tree level, so the anti-symmetric tensor decouples anyway, and the dilaton will decouple, if I'm just thinking about pure gravity. But if you're thinking about pure gravity with loops, then you better, you know, think about symmetrizing things. Okay, K1 plus K2. Okay, and then, let's see, so I'm just writing down the 2-point, a mu, k1. Now, I'm suppressing the color indices. They're not going to play a role here. I'm just going to suppress it. Minus 2, b mu nu rho. Okay. Okay, so there's my Yang-Mills Lagrangian, the kinetic term. Okay, let me add in the interaction term. Okay, delta D, K1 plus K2 plus K3. Yeah, uh-huh.
The first term is A mu contracted with A
mu. Because, what did I mess up? Hold on. Because I don't know what I messed up. I don't know why that was a new. Okay, I do know. It's because I wasn't paying attention. Okay. P6 by P6, it's a you have to permute. So this is a symmetrization. See, it takes a while to write down the Lagrangian, but to get the gravity one, that'll be easy. I'm just going to take two clones of this, two copies of this, will give me the gravity Lagrangian. That'll be valid until up to 4 points. So the gravity Lagrangian, we can just read off from here, because
how do I distinguish between h mu mu squared and h mu mu, trace of h squared?
Sorry, the trace? No, there is no trace. Oh, sorry, trace?
When you make, oh, I see.
Yeah, no, I don't want any. Traces will decouple. Yeah, that's like the dilaton. That's gone.
Can't get that.
Okay, so what is the gravity? What does the gravity look like? Well, I don't know if you want to watch me write it again, but yeah. But take this, multiply A goes to A twiddle. Okay, also you better rename your indices or you're going to get yourself really confused. And then over here, let's get rid of that. Let's make this gravity. And then, again, the same thing here, times A goes to A twiddle. And then, of course, B goes to B twiddle, right? Because I got an auxiliary field here. And then B goes to B twiddle here. And I multiply it, and that's the Lagrangian. Now I have to identify these products, right? So here, this guy times that guy, I identify as the graviton.
What do you do with the gauge indices? Are you tracing over them?
I am ignoring them.
No,
they're irrelevant. They.
Is that equal to one?
Yeah, they're irrelevant. Well, it's because I threw away, in doing this double copy, you throw away the color factor. So these indices, they can do whatever they want. They're completely irrelevant. You just make that identification.
Somehow you started with a Jacobi identity and color indices. So how can they be completely irrelevant?
How can they be completely? Well, no. All this talk about Jacobi identities, that was all on the Yang-Mills side. Okay, then we create the Lagrangian. And that Lagrangian is designed to satisfy the duality. As soon as we have that Lagrangian, forget about the Jacobi identity. You just double everything.
So you mean multiplying there?
I mean multiplying.
No. Not there. Ooh. Double. Wait, the plus you're pointing to.
Where is
it? Shouldn't there be a
term?
You don't need.
Oh, time. Oh, whoops. Sorry. Yeah, I definitely mean times. Otherwise, that would not be a cubic Lagrangian. And then my brackets might be off as well, aren't they?
Missing one bracket.
Yeah, there's some brackets that are.
And then the
off.
K1 should be K2, right?
Why
not?
Yeah. I lost where I was. K1. K2, no. Oh, this one, yes. This one's K2, right. Okay, now I think we're happy, right?
B is a totally symmetric number?
Yeah, this is to to completely symmetrize in the legs. So it's basically swapping swapping the three cyclic and three anticyclic.
And that's the
P6. Yeah, the
P6. Field B is a totally symmetric thing.
I think at this level it's not specified.
But when you
where is it dotted into?
Well, when you couple it to the edges, it will only couple.
What's it coupled to?
Not specified, but it could be.
I can't remember. Maybe, you know, I don't remember. Maybe it's an end. Anyway, it's just dictated. It's just dictated by the Lagrangian itself. There's nothing.
So it's symmetric. Yeah. Mu or
right. Exactly. It's anti-symmetric and mu. There we go. Anti-symmetric and mu and nu. And then rho is whatever it wants to be. Now, this is all done by design. There's nothing special that we're imposing. You're just imposing right here, just that you get the right Feynman gauge Lagrangian. Okay? So if I integrate out the B, I'm supposed to get the Feynman gauge Lagrangian. But there's nothing special that we've imposed on this. It comes out as it needs to come out to make it work. So, like you said, this guy's anti-symmetric. Okay, and then there was something else important is there's auxiliary fields. You can already get a little hint of this drowning in auxiliary fields. So there's a lot of these fellows. Notice I'm just talking about let's give this guy a name, mu nu rho sigma, you know, etc. I'm just talking about the 4-point case here. When you go to 5-point, you'll find more auxiliary fields. 6 points, even more, and there's presumably an infinite tower of auxiliary fields that you need to do this. So it definitely smells a lot like string field theory. Now, what are we going to do with this? I'm almost done. What are we going to do with this? Well, what we'd really like is to understand the structure of this thing in one go. Find the Lagrangian. If you have that Lagrangian, you then want to, of course, look at classical equations of motion, for example. And what you would like is a formula that is very, very generally relates classical solutions. Now, the reason why I can stand here and say this with a straight face is because we can see this double copy relation at the Lagrangian level. Right? And if we could clean it up and make it work all in one go, you'd really think that classical equations of Yang-Mills and gravity are related through a double copy. Maybe I'll even write down a formula. Well, I have to turn off our camera if I'm going to write down the formula. Okay, I'll write it down.
You can do that.
It's okay. And I'm going to write down a formula I'll give it a name. I'll call it the vague formula. And it's vague for multiple reasons. So first of all, give it the name, the vague formula. So this would be the metric. And it's a solution. It could be, let's say, a solution of a black hole. And what we want is for it to be a double copy of Yang-Mills solutions, maybe a monopole. Now, it's probably a convolution because notice I'm working in momentum space here. So if it's a product in momentum space, it's probably going to be a convolution in coordinate space.
Something like Riemann tensor on the left-hand side and two FMUs on the
right-hand
side?
It could be.
Which at least have the same symmetry property.
It might be. Now, you're also probably going to tell me my dimensions were wrong, so I just fixed that. So at least now it has the right dimensions. But what you should take away from this is the key thing is convolution integral and then a product. You know, it's like the convolution. Now, the vaguest part about this formula is it has to do with the field variables. I didn't tell you what you should do on this side. What are the field variables? You tried the Donder gauge or any other of your favorite gauges or coordinates, forget it. It's not going to work. This side, the same thing. So the two sides of the equation, I have not specified the particular gauge it's supposed to work in. Now, if we had a Lagrangian and the Lagrangian was clean, not this order by order nonsense, but the, you know, the Lagrangian, then I think we could just go solve the classical equations or write down the classical equations of motion from the Lagrangian, compare, and so figure out what we're supposed to do. I think I do.
I mean, if you're talking about the actual metric and not the perturbation, then we have to first get Minkowski space out of a formula like this. Right? So there's a non-trivial gauge field.
Well, at least we can get this formula, or maybe if it's written properly, this formula will definitely work for the S matrix. So it's not completely stupid in the sense that we know that, you know, it's basically what I was showing. But beyond that, anything beyond the S matrix, we don't know how to go beyond that. And in fact, I hope I can stimulate conversation and maybe even some real work to figure out how to make this into a real formula, not a vague formula.
There is an A to U term also.
No. Oh, definitely not. No. Yeah, absolutely not, because those two copies, yeah.
Fine with these ideas that there could be, you know, zero metrics or degenerate metric solutions that you get from something.
Yeah, no, we don't want to trace.
No, but the identification is H being last
year. Oh, yeah, I don't know, because...
It could,
but the thing is, here at least, I can do perturbation theory and go to the S matrix from a formula like this.
I don't have
anything against the Riemann tensor. Maybe that's
vacuum expectation value of the right hand side is zero, starts out. And the vacuum A is dependent. The other side isn't.
Yeah.
And your identification is H.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's okay. Yeah.
So add an A.
That's right. Yeah.
Add an A to the right hand.
Yeah, okay. Here.
Add a what?
Here, I'll make you.
Yeah.
Yeah, here. Happy?
Yeah.
Now, it's still a vague formula. It's not going to help. Anyway, I hope that that we can make this a non-vague formula.
If the classical equation, this might be true in some perturbative sense, but there's plus. Because in classical equation, you sum all the tree diagrams, and you just told us, if you look at all the tree diagrams, you're getting an infinite number.
So that's another, right. So this formula here cannot possibly be right without having basically that this object is not the A field, really. This object is some object that has an infinite number of auxiliary fields. Then that formula can make sense. It definitely will not make sense, even in perturbation theory, this is all messed up, unless you've got yourself an infinite number of auxiliary fields. Okay, let me just finish up with a few comments. So. Where do we want to go, or what are some open problems?
No, on the gravity side, when you integrate out the auxiliary field, you get the full Einstein gravity only up to a certain term.
When
you make that identification. You have this 4-index thing and a 6-index thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
BB.
Yeah, it's Einstein gravity.
The whole thing.
Yeah, up to only to the order of perturbation theory that I'm talking about. So it's not the whole Lagrangian. It's only, here, the thing I was talking about, it's only 4 gravitons. If I did it to the next level, 5 and then 6. And what we would really like is to fix that, right? All in one go. Okay.
So there are connection formulations, pure connection formulations of gravity by, they were capital Adela Jacobson, back in the 90s. But
Yeah, I'd be surprised to see that it's actually addressing fully like this. I mean, it's, if you linearized it, I just wouldn't.
Yeah. No, well, it's
their formula is basically a first order formula. I mean, it's like E wedge, E wedge, D of the spin connection or something like that.
That's right, it's a spin connection, and then and they have the cosmological constants make it run as well.
You can put a cosmological constant.
It's a general execution, I think.
You have extra field beyond H mu nu.
Yes. Absolutely.
You argue that having done this copy,
right,
assuming you've done it all, you could integrate out the auxiliary fields and end up with just Einsteinian gravity?
Order by order, yes, for sure. I mean, you know, so any order we do it to, you integrate out the auxiliary field, it's just Einstein gravity.
How do you know that?
Oh, because it reproduces the S matrix correctly, so it's the correct, right? It's the correct Lagrangian to that order.
Tree approximation, absolutely.
Right.
It produces its own shell.
Yeah.
Action, right?
Yeah, but it's a valid action. To find the connection between this object and the Einstein one, it's a very non-trivial field redefinition. Now, we know actually quite a bit about what that field redefinition would look like because of it's an old paper I did with Aaron Graham that discusses field redefinitions that put you into not like what I'm talking about, but essentially a factorization it's the double copy without the other copy being Yang-Mills. So it's just a factorization of indices left times right. So you see there's two indices here, and here it's been factorized.
Right.
So we understand the field redefinitions that make that happen. And I'm pretty sure that if we wanted to, we would go ahead and find the field redefinition that gets you to honest to goodness Einstein gravity as written down by Einstein.
And what kind of field redefinition?
It's a very complicated one. I mean, what does it look like?
You say complicated.
I mean, yeah. Yeah. It's an unenlightening one. Is
are they non-local? These field
redefinitions? No. These are local field redefinitions.
Yeah.
If I remember, it was. You needed to do this. Wait, give me a second. With something like this, G mu nu goes to e to the something like this. This was an important part of it. That
I don't even know.
Perturbations. This is the original.
No, but that's one is a tensor and one is.
No. Well, what's the? Yeah, just expand out the exponential, and then it's a matrix multiplication, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then this field redefinition, I can tell you, is important in making the connection. Like I said, it wouldn't necessarily be enlightening. Okay, so let me just finish up. So the let me go through a list of open problems. No, but don't worry. The list will be doable. There's an undoable list, but most of this will be quite doable, I think. So probably the most important thing is we've got to get better representations. So even at tree level, we want better representations. At one loop, we definitely want better ones. That's like the toy place to start thinking about loops. But probably most importantly, once the trees and the one loop are completely understood, is we want better representations of the planar amplitudes as high as we can go. So tree, one loop, and then the planar amplitudes. As I explained in the beginning, the planars are the key. If we understood how to put the planar amplitudes in the proper form, then it's just, it gives us the non-planars immediately, and then we get our double copy. And this, of course, I'm talking about at the level of the integrand. We want probably better variables. Kind of old-fashioned. You saw I wrote down a polarization tensor, a polarization vector. It's related to better representation, better variables. Andrew Hodges had very nice brackets. We want something like that. Now, there's also the issue of looking at the integrated level. Okay, this is, of course, a much harder problem, but it's also a harder problem at the planar case. If we can, you know, the more progress we can make in the planar case to go from the integrated to the integrand to the integrated, and again I'm talking about amplitudes, anyway, the more we do at the planar level, obviously the more we will be able to do at the non-planar case. Very important is we really want a better Lagrangian. So the message you should get from me is on the Lagrangian is it exists, right? A Lagrangian exists that gives us the duality, right? But we want to do better than just order by order, obviously. And a key reason why we want to do better is we want to think about pushing it out of perturbation theory. We want to push it to general solutions. Now, the way I would approach this problem is to try to stick close to perturbation theory, at least in the beginning, to investigate. Let's make it other classical or classical solutions. Classical solutions. Yeah. So the way to find first a better Lagrangian and also to study how to get away from perturbation theory is to look perturbatively at other classical solutions and try to gain insight to do this step. And I'm pretty sure something can be done here. It's just a matter of really sitting down and investigating various classical solutions. And underlying this, there's some kind of group theory, right? So those numerators, they satisfy the same Jacobi identities as color, and that's really the key, right? None of this double copy stuff would work unless that group theoretic structure was behind it. So we have got to figure out what the heck this group is, right? That's what we want to know. What's that group? Now, that one, I think it's harder. Well, it could be a very easy problem if you have the right insight. If you don't, it could be a very hard problem. It's unclear what calculation you should do to learn what that group is. But that is what we really want. I think it's pretty clear there's something very important here to track down what's causing the group theoretic structure of these numerators. And clearly that's something fundamental to gravity, because it's those same numerators are the building blocks for gravity. And then while we're at it, why not an all-loop proof of the duality so that we're sure it's true? Okay.
Isn't it true that you can have solutions
and the what relations?
The Bonus relations. Isn't it true that you can have solutions that satisfy the Bonus relation but doesn't satisfy the BCGA?
Nima?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Is that true?
I mean, because it looks like BCGA is slightly stronger.
Is that true? I didn't know that. I think.
Yeah, I don't know either.
So that means,
because it's just But I guess I meant the but Mr. J is exactly as strong as the partial order. The statement about the some combination of different color energies. That is the full gauge and Gram content.
Right, that's a gauge and Gram content.
Right. You're saying that the bonus relations imply that, but it's a stronger statement.
Yeah, because the numerator, the fact that numerator is that does not directly.
Anyway, at least the proofs I've seen, just briefly, that prove it from the bonus relations are not particularly numerous. I can show you Freddy's construction for the Lucas's strength, which is very limited. It's a five-line proof.
Oh, yeah, I think we're dead.